We in Western Australia have sometimes been visited by people like the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, and I think there was a gathering of an American-Australian Friendship Association a couple of years, and a lot of important figures came to Western Australia, all behind closed doors, invitation only. How important is Western Australia overall to the picture of the world that you're describing?
WA, of course, is very important, not just because it's rich in minerals, but because of the Lancelin training base, which allows weapons testing, live firing, and so on to occur. Garden Island West is over there. As the United States gets closer and closer towards its goal of encircling China via the concept of the Indo-Pacific, then WA will become more important because of the Indian Ocean. So we used to talk about the Asia-Pacific, but then in 2016, the white paper, and 2017, another white paper brought in the concept of the Indo-Pacific, which was mentioned like, you know, 60, 70 times in each document. And I'm talking about the defense white paper and the foreign affairs white paper. And the attempt is to bring in India, Japan, and Australia, along with the United States, to be a counterweight to China and rename the Asia-Pacific as the Indo-Pacific. And this would mean a two-ocean strategy. So you'd have the Indian Ocean being more heavily patrolled. In that sense, WA would be increasingly important.
Welcome to Understory, this 14th day of October 2020. I'm Elizabeth Poe. Today we hear a replay of an important Understory episode that first went to air on July the 15th this year. While environmentalists tend to be driven by a passion for nature, often that means that longer conversations about military doctrines and economics seem a long way away from acting on the climate emergency or the lack of environmental or heritage regulations constraining mining companies in Western Australia. All these matters have come to a head with the extraordinary amounts now being given to military spending. Apart from the existing military budget of half a trillion dollars or more, an extra $270 billion is going to be spent on military equipment over the next 10 years. Money that was only months ago completely unavailable for action on climate change, water and soil remediation, transport infrastructure, species survival, or action on abandoned mines. For decades, successive governments have said the money is not available for environmental action. But this money will buy action for the military that neatly dovetails with larger international objectives of the Trump administration. For the Morrison government's generous expansion of military spending is not just money that's being committed without context. Only last week, the US Congress allocated an extra $750 billion of its own money to prepare for war. And the money that Australia is spending on hardware is going to be able to be easily dovetailed into American operations. The watchword is interoperability. It means that Australia works as if it is neatly part of the American military forces. It is encouraged, therefore, to buy equipment produced by the Americans rather than necessarily being the best value for money. Here, Understory reporter Adrian Glamorgan takes up this question as we bring you the second part of an interview with Professor Clinton Vernandez last month.
The single most important criterion for purchasing major equipment is interoperability with the United States, not performance. You might have seen there's a lot of debate about the Joint Strike Fighter, the F-35, the Collins-class submarines in the past, the replacement to the submarine fleet, the air-to-air refuelers. The number one criterion for purchasing is interoperability with the United States, not the performance or its relevance to the actual defense of Australia.
Australia has supported wars of choice with the Americans, but each has proved to be costly and destabilizing, generating tens of millions of refugees while adding to global environmental destruction through the damage to infrastructure, water, toxic waste, and opportunity cost. According to Professor Fernandez, Australia's own investment in these wars was based on a very narrow criterion.
The second thing that's also obvious is we participate in American-led expeditionary operations. There was enough declassified material that's come out now to show that the alliance with the United States was one of the two principal factors that led John Howard to join the US-led invasion of Iraq. The second one was access to Iraqi markets for Australian wheat. But the number one factor was the US alliance. And we need the US alliance because we are locked into global value chains. And the alliance is meant to defend that too. That's what's meant by rules-based international order. So those are the two most obvious factors.
But apart from wars in foreign places, there's the matter of Australia's key contribution to the American presence in what they call the Indo-Pacific.
Then you've got things like Pine Gap, the joint defense facilities at Pine Gap, about 20 kilometers south of Alice Springs in the Northern Territory. Well, Pine Gap is a way to bring us into the US-led warfighting machinery. It was supposed to be based on arms control and verification, but actually what it does is provide us with or lock us into the US's warfighting machinery. We have another near the town of Exmouth. It's called the Harold Holt Communications Center on Northwest Cape.
Harold Holt is the most powerful transmission station in the Southern Hemisphere, broadcasting to submarines in Indo-Pacific waters. Back in the 1960s, when Exmouth was built to house American service personnel, US cars were imported and drove on the other side of the road. US currency was used. American food was imported. And they built a large baseball pitch and 10-pin bowling alley. Northwest Cape was later described as a joint facility named after Harold Holt, the Australian Prime Minister who once said Australia was all the way with LBJ. The US government formally handed command of the base over to the Royal Australian Navy in 1992. Management and operation of the Harold Holt Naval Communications is now the responsibility of Raytheon, a United States private contractor, one of the largest defence companies in the world. Apart from managing Harold Holt, it is involved in drones and nuclear weapons. And last month, the US Air Force announced that Raytheon would develop a new fleet of nuclear air-launched cruise missiles.
What that Northwest Cape base does is it provides communications to submarines, to US submarines, and it allows orders for US submarines to attack other submarines in the event of hostilities, like, for example, Chinese ballistic missile submarines. It allows those orders to be transmitted from the Northwest Cape without Australia's knowledge. And that obviously locks us yet again into the US warfighting machinery. Meanwhile, the legislature, our parliament, has limited its own ability to have oversight of the intelligence services. In the United States, the Senate Intelligence Committee and the House Intelligence Committee have oversight. They actually inquire into the affairs of the intelligence agencies. They can reach deep into them and ask what are the problems. The leader of the House and the leader of the Senate in the US, as well as the deputy leader, the minority leader in both, are called the Gang of Four. They see the same intelligence as the US president. All these reforms were brought in after Nixon's secret bombing of Cambodia. In Australia, on the other hand, the Parliamentary Joint Committee on Intelligence and Security, by its own charter, cannot examine any operation, past, present, or proposed. It can only examine the administration and financing of the agencies. So that locks out any prospect of democratic oversight. I know that you've got a politician in WA who is, I think, the chair of that committee.
That's Andrew Hastie, member for Canning, one-time troop commander in the Special Air Service Regiment.
The Parliamentary Joint Committee on Intelligence and Security, it's often referred to as the powerful PJCIS. It's not. The PJCIS is the most absurdly limited committee that we've got. And there's a reason for that. It's because we are a sub-imperial power. It's important to reduce democracy and oversight if that sub-imperial status is to be retained.
In terms of what people should be talking about, it sounds like the committee that's responsible for overseeing spying and intelligence in Australia ought to actually have expand its powers, and also in wars of choice that Parliament play a greater role.
Oh yes, look, the United States, for example, has the War Powers Resolution 1973. It's not the War Powers Act. It was a resolution because they didn't want to fully tie the U.S. president's hands, but it reaffirmed the fact that that only the Congress can declare war. The Commander in Chief remains the president, and only the Congress, namely the legislative branch, can declare war. In Australia, there is no such provision. The Prime Minister and the Defence Minister can simply order troops into wars of choice, That is really not under attack. It's not a war of necessity. And there's simply no oversight of the intelligence that justifies that war of choice anyway. And so if Parliament were to insist that any war of choice be preceded by and subject to authorization by Parliament, that would be a democratic check. It wouldn't stop wars, I have to say, but it would ensure that the cost of going into an unnecessary war, a war of choice, is raised. And that can be a good thing for democracy.
Clinton Fernandez works at ADFA, but previously was with Army Intelligence.
Clinton Fernandez, there's a very important issue that lurks with Pine Gap and Northwest Cape and possibly other surveillance facilities. Could Australia be complicit in a war crime or a first strike nuclear attack without even having a say over it?
Well, war crimes, the satellites that sit above the equator in a geostationary orbit from Yemen to around Japan are controlled by the ground station, which is Pine Gap. And so automatically, any drone attacks that rely on intelligence from those satellites involve Pine Gap. That's just a law of physics. It's just not even debatable. And so, yes, if there are any strikes that are in violation of the laws of armed conflict, then yes, Pine Gap and Australia is obviously involved in it, yes.
And in the case of a nuclear launch by the United States?
It depends on where the launch would be done. One can't automatically say that that we are locked in, because there are other signals intelligence bases around the world. There's one at Menwith Hill in, maybe I'm pronouncing it wrong, Menwith Hill in near Yorkshire in the United Kingdom, which is one of the two most important intelligence bases outside the United States. The other one, of course, is Pine Gap. Then you've got Waihopa in New Zealand, and there's a couple more around the world of lesser importance. And so it just depends on where the intelligence is coming from that would lead to a first strike. But with the real danger of a nuclear thing starting is Northwest Cape. That's the Harold Holt communication station near Exmouth, because there are sensors, undersea and overhead sensors, in the South China Sea, which allow the United States to track Chinese ballistic missile submarines. And U.S. hunter-killer submarines can attack them and destroy them at the start of a conflict. And that is very dangerous, because it reduces China's second strike ability, and therefore they have a greater incentive to launch a first strike. So in that sense, yes, the threat of nuclear war is increased because of the ability to attack these submarines, and we don't even have any control over it.
Now, if Australia or New Zealand wanted to get rid of these spy bases or limit their use to conform to international law and Australian sovereignty control, what would the impacts be on those governments?
Well, I think if it happened in New Zealand, there would almost certainly be a coup. You know, that's just it's a small country, you can't resist. There would be, I don't say a coup in the sense of, you know, people running in the streets and storming the parliament and shooting people. I'm talking about a vote of no confidence in whoever was the prime minister of the day. And the US embassy's fingerprints would be all over it. And that's what would happen. There would simply be a removal of the prime minister by a vote of no confidence. In Australia, it's a bit different, because there is a very, very vocal pro-US lobby, which is always talking about how they're being swamped by a Chinese lobby, which is actually quite small. But the pro-US lobby would make life impossible for any prime minister that even thought about this. It's just not, I just don't see it happening. Because in order to get to the front bench of either major political party, you basically have to be vetted. We know from the WikiLeaks cables that there's almost a kind of audition that occurs when key people in politics go and meet the U.S. ambassador or the U.S. political counselor. And they have to reassure them about their commitment to the alliance. Otherwise, if any skepticism expressed, then there'll be messages passed on to opinion piece columnists in the newspapers, radio stations, think tanks, and a ton of bricks will fall on anybody evincing doubts about the U.S. alliance.
Well, that rather sounds like Whitlam in 1975.
Oh, yeah. And in fact, he was pro-U.S. People forget that he was far more supportive of the United States in Vietnam than the person who was leader of the Labour Party at the time, Arthur Calwell. And he talked about being at home in Asia, but it was always understood that the United States alliance was the centerpiece. What had happened was, when they set up Pine Gap and they set up ASIS, the Australian Secret Intelligence Service, in many respects, it was held in a very tight compartment. The opposition leader at the time was never briefed about that. Arthur Calwell had been told for another reason, but Whitlam had not been briefed until he became prime minister about the existence of ASIS, about certain activities that were occurring in Pine Gap. And when he named a man called Richard Stallings, who was a CIA man, happened to be a tenant renting a flat or a house from Doug Anthony, the then leader of the National Party, and he began to make noises about Pine Gap because he hadn't fully been briefed about what was involved. There was a huge amount of criticism and pushback from the United States Embassy. Now, I know that his biographer has won some High Court victory that gives her access to the Queen of England's, you know, Queen of Great Britain, Queen of Australia's private letters to the Governor General. I'd be very surprised if anything were found there. I don't think the Brits had anything to do with it, with what happened with Whitlam.
Australia is a valuable part of the United States global supply chain. These economic interests are narrowly defined around resources, particularly mining, according to Professor Clinton Fernandez from the Australian Defence Force Academy.
How do you think the mass media manages all of the information that you've shared with us? You've spoken in various forums, webinars, and you have articles in The Conversation, Clinton Fernandez. But how responsible is the mass media in opening up the debate about commercial and military questions?
Look, I think that it's a very narrow debate. The most honest part of the mass media are the business pages. And in fact, much of what I'm talking about comes from reading the business pages of, you know, most newspapers. Of course, the Financial Review, the Financial Times, you know, in the UK, the Bloomberg professional database. But no, it's not conveyed to the general public. This information is available if one is willing to do an enormous research project and bring it together. But it's very difficult to break through, and that's understandable. I mean, in the first instance, the op-ed commissioning editors generally are not aware of this sort of stuff. They are all, you know, inside I wouldn't say a club, that makes it sound a little conspiratorial, but there's a shared habits of mind and shared understandings which limit the discussion to a self-referential circle.
You're with Understory. While this week and last week we've been speaking to ADFA Professor Clinton Fernandez, who is raising important questions about Australia's sovereignty and capacity to manage its own affairs because of our narrow economic base, which has given the United States enormous influence over our military and foreign policy. Now, this means Australia's spending an extra $279 billion on military hardware that will fit in with the US fighting approach. It means Pine Gap and the potential for Australia to be complicit in drone war crimes for anywhere between Yemen to the Sea of Japan. It means Northwest Cape, which could drag Australia into a nuclear conflict or play a part in an American first strike in the South China Sea without Australia having much say over it. There is the lack of oversight over intelligence and security in our own country. And there's also the issue that currently the Australian Parliament has no say about when Australia goes to war. The environment movement in Western Australia has campaigned vigorously for habitats, species, and the climate emergency. Yet there is still a leap to be made about the confluence of environment with peace. The Australian government's commitment to spending hundreds of millions of dollars on war making may change that. Either way, the former Army intelligence worker, Clinton Fernandez, now professor at Australia's prestigious tertiary institution for the Defence Forces at ADFA, is showing us all the Pine Gap in Australia's defences. I'm Elizabeth Poe. Thanks to Adrienne Glamorgan for this and last week's report. If you'd like to hear the programme again, hop online to stream on rtrfm.com.au or subscribe to our podcast. Meanwhile, we will be back next week at the same time, as there's always more to explore with Understory, radio for the planet.